Nation comes from the necessity to avoid having, for instance, Russia and China join together politically or economically. That would create such a huge block that it would dwarf the Americans.
Well, that's already happening.
Yeah, but the thing is that all of this push towards war, the sort of defunding of the social safety nets, the intention to defund Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and invest it in a war to basically get rid of your competition. I think that that's part of what we're seeing. And I think that this fear-mongering is just fear-mongering, but at the end of the day, you'll see whether or not you keep your social safety nets in.
Well, I think it's very likely everything that that's being proposed is going to come to fruition. I don't think that there's going to be a safety net. Social. I think that America has been and is continuing to be transformed into what we used to refer to as a banana republic. And I don't think that's going to change. So I guess it's just a matter of perspective. I'm not so much into the analysis as I am into solutions. We have to go, though. So I want to say we're out of time, and I want to say stay tuned to Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. This has been Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight with Catherine Davis, Paulette Spencer, and Matt Mazza. And we are going to sign off with Brian Jackson, Gil Scott-Heron, A Prayer for Everybody, and then I'll Follow the Sun, Beatles for Sale. We'll see how much of that actually plays as we make transition to the next program.
Cool.
So good night, all. And tune in on Mondays at 1 p.m. for the continuation of Heart of Mind.
This is a prayer for everybody in the world. Cause I am you and you are me, and we need each other. This is a prayer for everybody. Man can
to sea I've gone, for tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Someday you'll know I was the one, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend, in the end you will know. Oh, one day you'll find that I have gone, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend, in the end you will know. Oh, one day you'll find that I have gone, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun.
And more stuff. Stop talking, Kathy says, but I'm a BAI person. Jeez. Hello, everybody. Good morning. What's the whole title? Heart of Mind, what? Heart of Mind. Earth at Midnight was brought to you live with portions on recording. Unfortunately, Gil Scott-Heron wasn't actually in the studio. If he were, I'd just be getting autographs and bowing and kowtowing. I lived for the revolution will not be televised, which turned out not to be true. But it doesn't matter. His art, his mind, his soul were among the greatest things of the best minds of our generation. And Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight is something that follows that philosophy. And after the dust settles, and if and when I start at 1 a.m., I have to say that the soul of what that show does is a late night show, in my opinion. As opposed to 1 o'clock show. There's stuff to do at 1 in the afternoon, yeah. But midnight is a better way to find people's hearts and souls, in my opinion. But I am but a leaf in the wind, and I get canceled and renewed and I earn a half hour, I lose a half hour, whatever. But Wednesday night, it's Robert, don't go away, Paulette, it's Robert Knight's time. It has been since the 80s when he first came here. He says because of a premium I was offering, he said that was the first time he came to WBAI. Because I had a premium of a fabulous poster for a Broadway show called Warp. It was done by a comic book artist, and Robert had to have that. So he actually donated $50, which, by the way, in late 1970s money, is a lot of money. It's not nothing today. And I don't remember exactly when Earthwatch began. This is, by the way, approximately the 45th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf. Believe it or not, in the last week or two, because I'm not sure what day it began, but it began in January 1972. Earthwatch 78. So Earthwatch on the air Wednesday nights for 30. That's right. He was outed for really horrific reasons, or lack of logical reasons. But, hey, It's not water under the bridge. We're still living with some of the problems. But to me, okay, we don't own time slots. I didn't own Saturday mornings 5 to 7 a.m., even though I was there for 39 years before I was removed from there. But I understand it's not ownership, it's a lease. But for me, there's a thing about what a time slot feels like, what it offers, what it does. And Earthwatch had a very specific feeling that while it wasn't what Hour of the Wolf does, it dovetailed so well, which is why I'm so happy, so easy about Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight, flowing into Hour of the Wolf and all that. Robert and I never gave a bleep about that because it's about airflow and thought flow and feeling flow. And while I applaud health programming, I really think that there's something about the spirit that Robert and Paulette and Kathleen, Catherine, where did Kathleen come from? Somebody else, never met her. Catherine have been doing through for 31 years, 39 years with time off for good behavior. So I know you're not talking, Paulette, but I just wanted to say that in your presence. Thank you. I think the station and these listeners owe you and Catherine and Robert a lot. That's all. Okay. The rest of it, as I say, I'm a leaf in the wind. But what I am is, I guess, the station's oldest volunteer, having started in 1967. Other people got paid. People before me, like Bob Fass and Janet Coleman, they predate me. But they're the only two. But they got paid for their work at one time or another. I'm just a volunteer. Excuse me, unpaid staff member. So I wanted to share my heartfelt feelings. Thank you. That being said, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial. Oh, God, is it non-commercial? Listener-sponsored radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And you know what? We usually tend to start out with a howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is morning. Dan Persons reviews the lore. I'm going to chat. And we're going to hear a very short story relevant to these times. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I've noticed an odd thing, only tangentially associated with the film I'm going to talk about, but I wanted to raise it anyway, see if anybody can come up with exceptions. Get in touch with the show's host if you can. Does it strike you that whenever a film has a magical or fantasy character who's mute, can't talk, or at least can't talk in the language that the film was made in, the character is almost invariably female? Off the top of my head, I can come up with a healthy handful of examples. Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid, Date with an Angel, Life Force, although I think that character talks at the end of the film, The Little Mermaid for most of its length, even the title character of The Witch, briefly glimpsed though she is, doesn't talk, and when evil is given a voice at the end, it's definitely male. Only example I can think of immediately of mute males is in Life Force. Don't cite Harryhausen, okay? He couldn't do lip-sync, so he gets a pass. Whether the characters themselves are benign or malevolent, there is a bit of malevolent wish-fulfillment in throwing in that aspect to a female character. I don't have to go into detail about what this says about a creator's image of the ideal woman. And I'm not going to get militant about this. I'm not campaigning for change. In the vast cinema landscape, this kind of stuff is rare. It's just an oddity that maybe should be balanced out occasionally. The lead characters of the Polish horror fantasy musical comedy, The Lure, two mermaids named Golden and Silver, played by Michalina Olszanska and Marta Mazurek, respectively, are, fortunately, not denied their voices at all. In fact, their introduction comes as they emerge from the water before the members of a strip club rock band, singing of their desire to come ashore and promising that they won't eat anybody, which probably should have been a warning sign right there. What follows is a kind of grown-up rewrite of The Little Mermaid, with Golden and Silver becoming the stars of a seedy little strip club with an act that has them singing and dancing with their newly sprouted human legs, and then capping it off with a dip in a giant glass tureen to reveal their shockingly immense fish tails. Those tails, by the way, are the only place to find their genitals. When they have their legs, they are, as one character points out, smooth as Barbie in the crotchal area. And so when Silver falls for one of the human musicians, things start getting a little complicated. There's a certain touch of Baz Luhrmann to director Agnieszka Smozinka's approach to the tale. She jumps easily from one musical genre to the next, from Europop to punk to new wave, and works motivations for the songs well into the narrative. The film's atmosphere sends up a musical's hyperbolic look without the occasional cynicism that comes with Luhrmann's approach. But despite the film having a pretty clear-cut, if not completely original, narrative arc, it falters a little toward the end, particularly with a fake death tangent that only seems to exist to run out the clock. That's a minor knock in a film that's otherwise funny, weird, and sexily raunchy, and that is sharp enough that when one of its mermaids does lose her voice, the moment is looked upon with remorse rather than as an ideal. The Lure is yet another example of the good things that can happen to fantasy when it gets a healthy shot of Eastern European irony. We got it with Challenging Demon last year, and The Lure continues the trend of really welcome stuff coming from Poland. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Why mermaids? I mean, three of the things, including The Lure, that Dan cited there were mermaids. It's interesting. There are a lot of other mute women in fantastic fiction. Start with Finian's Rainbow, in which you have the woman who talks only by dancing. Her name is escaping me at the moment. She's not evil. She's a good guy. You okay? The closest thing you have to evil is a leprechaun who's turning human because he's falling in love, well, not just with the mute, but with, well, any female character with legs, basically. But it is a very interesting point. I can't think offhand, you know, maybe if I worked on it hard, I might be able to come up with one guy that would fulfill that. But yeah, Dan's right. It's mostly women. Well, Dan said if you want to get in touch with the host of the show, you can do so. You can send an email to Jim, spelled J-I-J-I-M, at ourwolf.com. Remember that the radio show is called Hour of the Wolf. And so it's ourwolf, ourwolf.com. I've had that for so long that it goes back to the olden days of where first names of computer logins generally had to have 8 characters and an extension of 3. So you would have a file that would be like wperfect.com or .exe or something like that. Ourwolf.com, which for so many years has been on SFFnet. That stands for Science Fiction and Fantasy Net. And I'm mentioning this only because I'm so sad that after all these years, I've been on there, I think since 1995, a little bit before the web became commercial. Everything was .org, .net, .edu, .mil, but never .com. And or rather seldom, because that meant that it was commercial in nature. And, well, I'm not. Or I wouldn't be at WBAI, I suppose. But I am, and pleased with it. This is, as I was saying earlier to Paulette, I'm going to call it official for next week, because it's arbitrary. But we're in the 45th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf. Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf on WBAI Monday through Friday from 5 to 7 a.m. in 1972. I thought it was 1973. And that when Margot went away to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, that was 74. Except that one of her classmates from 1970, what I thought was 74, told me, no, it was 1973, I was there, your show began earlier. Thus, this is, you know, I go back to archive, Internet Archive, which I think is archive.org, where they have a lot of WBAI folios, program guides. And The earliest citation that I can find in print of Hour of the Wolf being on the air is like the first week in February, but I know it began earlier. I know it was somewhere in January. I just don't know the date. So let's just say that January, somewhere in January, we know January 10th was the first day that WBAI became part of the Pacifica Foundation. Some people call it our birthday. It wasn't our birthday. It's our anniversary because we already existed. But not as a listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio station, part of Pacifica. January 10th, 1960, became the first day that we were part of Pacifica. And I'll discuss that more next week, because next week will be the start of our next fund drive, this one being called the Resistance Fund Drive. Certainly an idea that I personally can get behind. We live in a science fiction time. I felt that first when we actually entered the 21st century. I'm old enough to remember that the 21st century was in the far distant future, that some of us would be living on Mars, that I would be commuting to the radio station, probably by air taxi. The driverless cars are barely beginning. They, you know, we're 10 years away from them being viable in cities, but they're in testing now, quite successfully, as a matter of fact. There are a number of things that are going on that are quite skiffy, skiffing being short for sci-fi, sci-fi being short for science fiction. And some of those have come true. But the year 2001 was a vast disappointment. It meant for us, it's the first year. 2000 was not the beginning of the third millennium, nor was it the beginning of the 21st century. That was January 1st, 2001. There was no year zero. So you have to begin with the number one. And 2001 was supposed to be way cool. But here we are in 2017. And what it feels like is 1984. And let me tell you something, speaking of science fiction. It's not a coincidence that 1984 has once again, this is amazing, has become a bestseller. The publisher ran out of copies and has had to go into another print run. That's the good news, that people are reading up on that, trying to see the likeness. The bad news is that another book that has been selling very, very well in these recent times is Mein Kampf. I suspect that the 1984 books are being bought by people who are resisting the state of the current government, and that the ones who are buying Mein Kampf are among those who are in, not cahoots, but in agreement. And they're not even really in agreement, but they don't know it. They think that the president, or as one person called him, the predator-in-chief, is a Nazi, a Hitler-like character. And no, he isn't. He isn't that at all. He's a reality show guy, and that's all that he is. What he is not is somebody suited to be a president of these United States. And so we're living in a reality show universe. It's the kind of thing that in the 1950s, Robert Sheckley wrote about a great deal. And there was a lot of dystopian science fiction of that era, just post-World War II. And the big question that is on so many people's minds is, how are today's politics going to affect speculative fiction, the fiction that purports to look into the what-ifs of our current reality and what-ifs of the future? 1984, it must be recognized, was written all about the year 1948 by Eric Blair, a fellow who wrote under the pseudonym George Orwell. And I don't believe he ever legally changed his name. I think his name was always Eric Blair. George Orwell is who we know him as and will do for us. The rest is trivia, but I love trivia. So anyway, dystopian science fiction is about to make one hell of a comeback. And next week, I hope to share some dystopian SF of slightly longer length. But tonight, I've chosen a story by Ray Bradbury. It's a very short story from 1951. It's not a dystopian story. It is a story of a totalitarian future. It's set in 2053, to be precise. So 102 years from when it was written. And I would start reading it now, except for the fact that I was meeting with a friend in a pub right near here that we were going to have a nice quiet talk. I went to the quiet section of the bar, but some people had the effrontery to be enjoying themselves and were having a birthday party, shouting at each other, standing 8 feet apart at the top of their lungs. And I think I did out my voice before the show. You can hear it. So I'm going to take a break to assuage that. And, oh, I had the foresight to bring a lovely sugar-free candy, which I almost just dropped. There we go. To soothe my mouth. But before we take a brief musical break, and the short story will last under 10 minutes, and after that I would like to hear from you. Take your phone calls at that time at area code 347-335-0818. Don't bother calling it now because I ain't going to answer. And share opinions on this world via surrealist and science fiction and fantasy in its many ways. But first, I always have a but first. Next Tuesday, we have an event, a wonderful event. I didn't print out the information on, but I know it pretty darn well. It's the February issue of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And reading for us will be two wonderful, wonderful writers. Jack Womack, whose last work of fiction, Random Acts of Senseless Violence, has got to be over a decade old at this point, but is one of, I think, seven wonderful, wonderful novels that he wrote. Elvisy and a whole series of wonderful things. And his most recent work is a work that you and I, well, I shouldn't speak for you, but Jack and I consider nonfiction. But I dare say any number of listeners out there consider it. We consider it fiction. Other people out there consider it nonfiction. The title explains it all. The title is Flying Saucers Are Real. It's a coffee table book with Jack is one of the most wonderful collectors of eccentric. I'm sure he has the word. He has a great vocabulary for what it is. He had a foreword written by William Gibson. I broadcast an interview with him about 6 or 7 weeks ago, and you can go into the WBAI archives and find it. But he's going to read from a new work of fiction, and he is going to read partly from Flying Saucers Are Real. Also on the bill, this is Jack's first reading for us in easily 10 years, but he's always been a favorite at the reading series. Now, it's only been about 2.5 years since James Morrow read for us, but even that is too long because Jim Morrow is such a wonderful character. I was talking about him a bit last week. And Galapagos Regained, I think, was his most recent novel. He writes books that both invoke and debunk religion. And he has another book coming out, which he will be reading from. I think it's coming out in April. And I'm sorry, I forget the title. As I said, I came unprepared. I didn't print it out, but you know what? Show up. Be there. You will have a great time. What it will cost you, admission is free. But we really, 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 really need your donations, just like WBAI. And so whatever you can give at the door is appreciated. We suggest $7, but if you have... But nobody will be turned away. That's the main thing. You can't afford that. You don't see your way through to that right now. Come in. It's more important that you show up and have a good time, and I promise you, you will. Oh, where should you show up? What a silly question. 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, which is actually where I am now, but I'm on the third floor, and the reading series is on the first floor in the Brooklyn Commons. And the time is 7 o'clock. It begins Tuesday, February 7th at 7 o'clock. And we will, I recommend that you show up at 6:30 so you have time to rub elbows, meet the other wonderful people who show up, settle yourself in, order something from the cafe, and sit down to enjoy the reading. So we let people in. We don't stop people from coming in earlier than 6. But if you do, then, you know, you just have me running around crazy working with... this month it will be Sam Schreiber running the video under the auspicious eye of Terrence Taylor. And me just being, well... nuts, as per usual. So 6:30 is a great time to show up. 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Street. And by the way, extremely easy to get you. More subway lines come here than to Times Square. That is a fact. Because it's about long... 5 blocks from the Barclay Center, a.k.a. the Atlantic Avenue stop / Barclay Center. You can get here more directly by Hoyt Schermerhorn, one of those. And you can even get here by the Long Island Railroad, would you believe it? It's true. It's true. So, 388 Atlantic Avenue this coming Tuesday, February 7th, starting at 7 p.m. If you don't come live, you can watch it online, but I hate telling people that because you ought to be here. So there. It's online through live stream, by the way. You can join the Facebook group, by the way, which will not only tell you more about it, but will have a link to the actual video feed that you can watch. Okay. I think we've covered that fairly well. I am going to take a break to hope to soothe my throat just a wee bit. And yeah, something just for the heck of it. This is Natalie Merchant.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition, and may God's love be with you.
Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing.